what will it be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips, what I get, me some. Will we fuss and fight when things go wrong? Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what will we will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries. Darling, I'll need no more reassuring.
Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word, would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who could ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love, or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what we will be. We can swim on the saints in our new beginning. Don't just let it be, no more inquiry.
Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet, These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. This hour of Arctic Entries will feature stories that make you go, seriously? We'll hear stories of skepticism, opportunity, and getting blindsided.
All these stories were originally told in April 2014 at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in Anchorage as part of our live event, like this story from Max Crows.
Now, if anybody here has ever had a number of Capri Suns, when you wake up the next morning, you might not be too startled to get a text message that says, hey, what time am I picking you up, and not know what it means. But you might be a little startled to check your email and find a receipt for a round-trip ticket to Mexico City that leaves that afternoon.
But before we start with the stories, here's local songwriter Anna Lynch.
I guess this is a song I wrote about romance and opportunity. Well, how do I get a little romance? How do I get a little fun? How do I get you all alone, boy? And how do I get me some? Well, how do I get you to stay? Boy, hold me close and oh, so sweet. How do I know that you love me so and you'll never ever leave? Well, how do I get a little romance? How do I get a little fun? How do I get you all alone, boy? And how do I get me some?
It's what they call a faux break. It's not a real break.
Sick and so, so gone, but I just love to see all their faces as I kiss you on and on. Well, how do I get a little romance? How do I get a little fun? How do I get you all alone, boy? And how do I get me some? Well, how do I get me a diamond ring? I'll pay the bills and half the rent.
That was Anna Lynch, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Lynch plays shows all over town with her band. If you liked that tune, she has show dates on her website, annalynchmusic.com.
Now for our first story. Kaylin Simon is a second-generation Alaskan.
And I hear, as far as state records are concerned, Kaylin was the first person listed as being born in Girdwood.
Really? The first person?
Yeah, that's what she says.
Okay, well, here's Kaylin Simon, live at Arctic Entries.
On March 24th, 1989, my community was changed forever. My parents had moved, I grew up in Cordova, and my parents had moved there shortly after I was born because it seemed like the perfect place to raise a family. It was calm and coastal and beautiful. The economy was thriving. The herring fishing was great. And above all, it just seemed like it was a world apart. Nothing could hurt you there or harm you, or you were safe and protected from everything. But when the Exxon Valdez oil spill happened, all of that security that we had was completely shaken. And the sense of community just kind of fell apart. And I was only 5 years old at the time that the spill happened, but even at five, you could tell that something wasn't quite right. All of the adults were very angry and upset. They were talking in hushed tones. the words Joe Hazelwood and Exxon and tankers and oil were being said all over in hushed, angry voices. There were camera crews in town, which that part didn't seem so bad because TV was really exciting, and it was the first time that I'd seen live camera crews. It seemed like maybe Cordova could be famous, so maybe the TV crews weren't bad. But you would look out at the harbor, and it was late March, so all of the boats should have been there, but instead, it was empty, because everybody that could have got on a boat or could have gotten themselves over to Valdez had gone over to help. No one knew what could be done, but they knew that they couldn't just stand by and sit at home and wait to hear what the result of this was all going to be and what the impact on their lives was going to be. They had to go see what they could do. And so the community really would have become more of a ghost town with all of these familiar faces gone, except that they were all replaced by Exxon and Vico and federal and state employees that came in and set up shop and were trying to mitigate the disaster and calm the angry citizens. And so the whole town just kind of got upended. So all of these things kind of came together to, even as a five-year-old, knowing this isn't right. This isn't my town. This isn't my community. And all of it was bad enough, but the thing that really drove it home for me was that at this time, we were in the middle of renovating our house, and we didn't have a roof on our house, and we didn't have stairs to go from the first story to the second story. And the contractors that were working on it, and my dad, had also taken off to go over to Valdez, and it was understood. You had to go. No hard feelings there. But my mom and I were left in this house, and we had vinyl covering the roof. The rain was pouring down on it, and you could watch it all pool, and we would cuddle up with blankets on the couch, and we were warm, and we were secure enough, but I can't imagine what it would have been like for her home alone with a five-year-old. And then the stairs that we had ordered the lumber from the lumber yard, but when Exxon and Vico came in, they apparently bought every piece of building material you could buy in the community, and also our custom ordered wood for our stairs, because they needed it for offices or oil spill mitigation. I'm not quite sure why they needed those exact pieces of lumber, but it left her without the ability to go and get the water that was only running downstairs and not upstairs, and so she had to take a ladder. And so we were left alone in this house, and all of these things are kind of adding up, and you know it's not quite right, but the thing that to this day really still stands out and helps me understand exactly how bad it was one day we came home, and there was a strange man in our house, and he seemed very angry, and he was cussing, and he was hammering on the roof, and he was putting our roof back on for us, but he didn't seem too happy about it. And apparently, my mom had bailed him out of jail, because that's what you do when every other able-bodied person is out helping with the oil spill cleanup. She essentially became his guardian for a couple months while he worked off the damages that he owed to somebody in Washington. And I'm not sure how, even as a five-year-old, I knew this. I'm not sure you would tell your five-year-old that this man should be in jail, but instead he's in your house. But that got out, and I knew this, and he was kind of scary. So that's the way you know it's bad. Because at five, people that are in jail should probably stay in jail. You know, the world is black and white. They shouldn't be in your house. They shouldn't be building your house, no matter what else is happening. And even though there are more stories from the oil spill and there are heartbreaking stories from our community and from my family, and, you know, even in the 25 years that has passed since then, there are so many things that come from it. And you grow up in Cordova with Exxon Valdez just kind of hanging overhead. It's something that you can't really separate yourself from, and it's a reason that I'm still in Alaska and that I'm doing the work I do today, but I always feel a little bit guilty because whenever I think about Exxon Valdez, I see the oil spill and the beaches and the images that you've seen of the birds and people trying to clean up beaches that will never really be clean, but it always comes back to this angry man that should have been in jail hammering away and cussing up a storm as he helped my family put our house back together.
That was Kaylin Simon, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. We'll hear stories about skepticism, opportunity, and getting blindsided.
Each storyteller has 7 minutes to share his or her story. You may have noticed the timer during that last story. At 5 minutes, the hosts of the live Arctic Entries show let storytellers know it's time to wrap things up. And then another timer sounds at 7 minutes to let the storytellers know it's time to make way for the next speaker.
Our next storyteller is Lori Moore. Lori's the type of person who heard the expression, have the time of your life, and then decided to just go and apply that to everything.
My story starts back in 2010. I was working as a tour director for a tour company. So people come in on these big cruise ships to the state of Alaska, and we take them on a land tour. We show them Denali and Fairbanks and Seward and Talkeetna. And it's really fun because you get to work with all these people and tell them where the rooms are at and whether there's internet and to go flight seeing and why they don't have a view room and all this other stuff. Oh, I was having a particularly rough week. It was nearing the end of July, so we were already more than halfway through the season, and I had a group from Long Island, 40 of them. There were other people on the tour, but I couldn't even tell you where they were from because the Long Islanders took over everything. So I was having a particularly rough week, and we arrived in Denali, and looking for solace with the rest of my coworkers after, you know, we get rid of all of the guests, we go basically gather up and talk about them. And so we had met up in a hotel room, and I go into the room, and I, like, flop down on the bed, and my friend says, what's going on? And I was like, man, I just don't feel good. Like, my vision just went blurry, and my stomach hurts. I don't know what's going on. And he's like, oh, I got this. You have gas. So he pulls out his wallet, and he takes out a little GasX pocket pack and hands it to me. He's like, try this. You'll feel better. So I take that, and then we go out to dinner, and probably stay out late, way too late, and I don't necessarily feel any better, but I say that I feel better. So fast forward to Labor Day, and it's the end of the season, and I've been working back-to-back-to-back-to-back tours, and I still don't feel any better. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, I've got this big trip planned. I've got a one-way ticket to Honolulu, and a couple of friends, we are going to get on a boat that took us all the way to Sydney. Working for a cruise company has its privileges. And that was going to be my winter. I was going to be in Australia for a couple months, and then I'd figure out when I wanted to come back, basically when the money ran out. And I decide that before I leave on this big adventure, I should probably go to a doctor, just in case. So I go to the doctor, and I have to get a CAT scan, and then I get this phone call, and then I've got to have surgery, and so my sister flies up, and the doctor says, you can't go on this trip because the recovery time's going to be too long, and you can't just be floating out in the middle of the Pacific. So fine. So I go and I get my surgery, and my sister's there when I wake up, and I'm in this morphine-induced stupor, and she comes to the side of the bed, and she's like, how do you feel? And I'm like, awful. And she's like, well, I don't know how to tell you this, but you have cancer, and the doctor said that you have cancer, and I have to tell you that, so there you go. Surprise! So, you know, you think you're constipated, and then all of a sudden it's cancer? So it turns out I had a tumor the size of a grapefruit on my ovary, and the next 5 months of my life was consumed with chemotherapy and the best time with my friends I've ever had. When was the last time you had 5 months off to do absolutely nothing? Think about it. It was so much fun. Hey, do you want to try to find the scariest horror movie? Yep. You want to come over for dinner? Sure. Hey, do you want to come over and help kids pass out Halloween candy? I'm in. So I go to my friend's house, and we're passing out Halloween candy. And by that time, I think I was probably into my second treatment, and so my hair started falling out into these big clumps, and it was getting really annoying to, you know, sweep up the house every day, and it just got everywhere. And so I was like, hey, you want to shave my head? So Snow White, it's Halloween, Snow White shaves my head and sweeps it up. And you know, it was probably a good thing because we were getting into winter, so it was kind of fun to have 1,000 different hats to wear all the time. Going out in public was a little bit different. I don't mind hanging out with my friends like that, but in public I felt like I needed to cover myself up to, you know, not really get some unwanted attention. And I remember for my friend's birthday party, he had rented one of the magic buses, and we like did this like pub crawl. And so I wore like this black Afro wig and like some 70s sunglasses and some tall boots, and just went out like nothing was the matter, and nobody knew, none the wiser. And, you know, I have blonde eyebrows anyway, so when I lost them, it didn't really make too much of a difference. And if you were talking to me, you might think, gosh, there's something not right with her face. Something's missing. But maybe you never knew. So it was really fun. I mean, spending all day in the kitchen making naan bread from scratch and grilling it and, like, having all this time, it was wonderful. So people would call up, like, do you want to go to Talkeetna for the weekend? Ooh, no, I'm not feeling so good. But really, I was reading the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series, and I couldn't put it down. Do you want to go to Arctic Entries? No, it was during the snow goose year, so I didn't want to wait in line for 2 hours and not get a seat. So life continued on. I ended up taking a beautiful trip to Maui with one of my other friends, and I went back to Michigan and visited my family, and basically, I didn't have anything else going on for the winter, so it was perfect timing. And I finished out my last chemotherapy session with a huge party, and all my friends were there, and they had like the caps over their heads that made it look like they were bald too. And it was really fun. And then I went on a cruise with my girlfriends before the next summer season started, and I was back on the road. So I learned a lot of things about cancer, and it was really hard to believe that that it happened to me, because I remember vaguely when the doctor was talking about it, that it was a possibility, but she said that the average age of, you know, people that get ovarian cancer is 60, and I was like 30 at the time, so that's not going to happen. So it just was right over my head. So was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer, and the survival rate at 5 years for that is 46%. So it's pretty low compared to, for example, breast cancer, which is really common, but at 5 years there's a 90% success rate, basically survival rate. So basically I was looking at maybe I'll live and maybe I won't, so I figured I might as well have a good time with it. But 3 years later now, I am here and I'm not going anywhere.
That was Lori Moore, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in April 2014. You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Our theme for this show is, seriously? The five Alaskan storytellers featured on this show volunteered to tell us something about their lives that was completely unexpected.
At each live event, we also feature songs from a local artist. Anna Lynch, originally from California, now lives and plays music here in Anchorage. This song, titled Bitter Bones, was also recorded live at Arctic Entries in April 2014.
I go walking like you all do down the street. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Arctic Entries on KSK Anchorage. Thank you, Anna Lynch, for the music. Now for more true stories from Alaskans.
Here's a story from Anchorage's Max Crows. One thing you'll learn about Max is that he is a super calm, cool, and collected supporter of the U.S. national soccer team.
So my story starts with a little bit of a soccer cheer, so if you guys would repeat after me, that'd be great. Oh, win the Yanks!
Oh, win the Yanks!
Go marching in!
Go marching in!
Hi, my name is Max, and I'm a supporter of the United States national soccer team. My story begins, like so many other of my stories, in a bar. I had had several of what we are going to refer to this evening as Capri Suns. And I had a head and a stomach full of Capri Suns when my buddy turns to me and says, "Hey man, are you gonna go to Mexico this weekend?" Now the United States had just defeated Costa Rica in a World Cup qualifying match, a win that put us one step closer to qualifying for the 2014 World Cup. And the United States was preparing to play Mexico that weekend at the famed Estadio Azteca, a 100,000-person fortress at a 7,000-foot altitude that the United States soccer team has never won a World Cup qualifying match in. I had to think about it for a minute. Not because that wasn't exciting, but because at the time, I had a part-time job running Facebook pages, and money was a little tight. He could tell that I was pensive, and he prepared to lean in and delivered an argument that I swear to this day should be presented in front of the Supreme Court. "Come on, man, it's Mexico!" "Yes, yes, 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 I'm in, let's go." Now, if anybody here has ever had a number of Capri Suns, when you wake up the next morning, you might not be too startled to get a text message that says, "Hey, what time am I picking you up?" and not know what it means. But you might be a little startled to check your email and find a receipt for a round-trip ticket to Mexico City that leaves that afternoon. When that happens to you, there's two questions you ask. The first is, do I have a passport still? And the second is, did the three Spanish classes I just so barely passed in high school mean anything right now? The answers were yes and no. And that's how I found myself in downtown Mexico City trying to find my game ticket from my buddy, Crazy Omar. His first name is Crazy. And he hadn't been answering his text messages all day. I finally got one that said, "Where you been, man? I'm leaving on this bus in 10 minutes. "Well, Crazy Omar, that's a little bit of a problem, buddy. Like, you didn't tell me where you are. You're now a mile away from me in downtown Mexico City, and I've got 10 minutes to find you." If anybody here has ever sprinted at full speed down a busy street in a foreign city, pretty much decked out like a make-believe Captain America, I'm gonna give you a spoiler alert. You turn a couple heads. It's now happened to me in Germany, the Czech Republic, South Africa, and Mexico. Get the ticket from Crazy Omar, but I've still got no way to get to the game. I didn't really plan this out that much. There's four buses that are leaving with a police escort to the stadium, but they're all full. And at this point, I've got to find somebody else that's going to the game. And this is that situation when you're in another country and you're trying to find another American. In this situation, it was the dude that was ironically wearing a Mountain Dew t-shirt walking down the Paseo de Reforma. After convincing this gentleman that he and his friend should indeed go to the game, he made a phone call. Now, I've made some good decisions in my life, like joining you great folks this evening at Arctic Entries. I've also made some bad decisions in my life, like agreeing to race my buddy in a 40-yard dash with the winner picking the loser's vanity license plate. But getting into a car with four people I just met in the busiest street in downtown Mexico City with the understanding that we're going to a soccer game, if anybody in the room makes PSAs, make one that says, "Don't do that." 3.5 hours later, I'm there. I was 15 minutes late. I turned my shirt inside out to clandestinely sneak into the stadium after the game had started. And it's just too much to behold. You're in a stadium of 100,000 people and 4,000 police officers, all of who are pretty angry that you're there. And this game, this is a big game. This game isn't a regular one. This is like the Boston Red Sox, the New England Patriots, the Bruins, playing the New York Yankees, Mets, Jets, Giants, and Knicks all at the same time on the moon while a blacklight flashes and Skrillex is playing. It's that crazy. This game isn't about winning or losing. The United States had never won on Mexican soil in a World Cup qualifier. This game was about representing. This game was about being there and being heard. It's a game that, for me, was about remembering why you take deep breaths, why you pound your chest during the songs. It's remembering that Clint Dempsey, our midfielder, our star midfielder, why he walks out onto the field every game representing our country, or why Jeff Cameron, our defender, whose haircut I stole, why he's proud to walk out and defend our team. At the end of the game, look up at the scoreboard. Mexico, nothing. United States, nothing. And for some people, that might not mean a whole lot. Soccer's boring. It was a tie. No. When you're standing with 500 of your friends behind two chain link fences that are topped with barbed wire, with hundreds of police officers in riot gear surrounding you, it's not about winning or losing. It's about being there and representing. Now, if you haven't been to a soccer game before, they don't always end on the friendliest note. The 100,000 people in the stadium, the 4,000 police officers, our presence was an assault on their cultural identity. They were not happy we were there. There was no van going to TGI Fridays for chicken strips and beers after this game. And normally, they'll let the stadium clear out and the away fans all leave afterwards when the parking lot is clear. Not in Mexico. They keep the Mexico fans in the stands while they try and usher you out past hundreds of riot police. Everything starts raining down on you. Shoes, batteries, bottles, you name it, it was thrown in our direction. And it was this moment that I turned to my buddy Garrett. And I looked at Garrett, and he had conveniently stowed away an emergency poncho in his pocket that he had pulled out and put over himself. And I thought about it, and he said, "Hey, man, they closed the concession stands like 30 minutes ago. Those cups they're throwing, those aren't full of beer." Seriously? So in that moment, what did I do? I took my shirt off, because I'm never going to let anybody get sick on my Alaska United States soccer jersey.
You just heard a live recording from our April 2014 Arctic Entries event. That was Max Crows.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to help them share their stories. Anyone may volunteer to tell a story at the Arctic Entries live show. You can learn more about that at arcticentries.com.
This next story is told by Don Reardon. Reardon is the author of the novel The Raven's Gift, among other works. Here, he provides a window into his own experience growing up in Alaska.
This was how I became a skeptic. I was in 8th grade. My family moved to an Alaskan village out on the tundra of southwest Alaska, a village called Kasigaluk. The place we moved into was this big, strange school building that just kind of rose up out of the tundra on steel beams. It was it's hard to explain what it looked like other than scary. It had a gym, it had a kitchen, it had a few little classrooms, and then our little tiny two-bedroom apartment. And then connected to this building were a couple outbuildings, a place for kind of the storage for the food, and an abandoned teacher's quarters, which was kind of strange, and a generator building, all connected to where I lived by these two really spooky above-ground tunnels. Now, everyone in the village, everyone, said our house was haunted. My friends couldn't sleep over. The cook wouldn't go down those long hallways without another adult with her to get food to bring it back to cook. strange things would happen. You know, the standard kind of haunting stuff. Lights going on and off, windows opening, doors closing, basketball bouncing down the hall in the gym. And I want to play ball, and I look out, and the gym's dark. But my mom, who, if you could imagine, is kind of like a female version of Indiana Jones, complete with the hat and the pistol. I'm not joking. really cool teacher. No whip, though. She taught without the whip, mostly. My mom had an explanation for everything. She could explain the lights going off, on and off. She could explain the windows and doors opening and closing. She could explain the basketball. And it was all the explanations, you know, like they made sense. The lights going on and off, that was a generator problem. The windows and doors opening and closing, that's just airflow, simple airflow. You've got these old, strange, abandoned buildings that are connected to your house and the long tunnels, and the wind comes through and those crazy Arctic winds, and you get suction, and that makes those doors open and close. The basketball, maybe, that just fell off the rack because the whole building's shifting because of permafrost and climate change. I'm in eighth grade. I was cooler than I am now. I'm down the hall talking on the phone in the principal's office because that's where the phone was. For those of you that don't know, phones used to have cords. And so I'm sitting there, I'm talking on the phone, being totally cool in the principal's office, my feet up on the desk, and across the office from me, a filing cabinet door goes, as if like opened by some invisible bony hand. I'm no longer cool. I gotta go. Slam the phone down, run down the hall, run into our apartment, slam the door, throw myself up against it. I can hardly breathe. And my mom says, "What's wrong?" And as soon as I can answer her, I was on the phone and the filing cabinet opened right in front of my face. And my mom said, "The big gray one?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "It's off balance or something. It always opens like that." "Why do you think we tape it shut?" Fast forward about 10 or so years. I'm a teacher out in the bush teaching myself. Let's just make it a dark and stormy night. Sitting there talking with my mom, and I'm a writer. I'm trying to make sense of some of these things that happened to me when I was a kid. And I was like, "Mom, what about that year in the village? All those strange things that happened." And she goes, "That was the scariest year of my life." Thanks a lot, Mom. "Really?" She's like, "Yeah." And she goes on to like tell me some of the scariest things I've ever heard. She's sitting there one night sleeping, and she wakes up, and my little sister's standing there next to the bed, and she's like 4 or 5 at the time, Shirley Temple curls. And she goes, "There's somebody standing over there, Mom." And Mom, you know, like she's like, get in bed with me. And she pulls the covers up over her head and like prays for sleep. "Mom, like really, how could you have done that?" And she said, "I didn't want my babies to be scared in their own house." And so what she's left me with is this. I'm really only skeptical now of people who have all the answers.
That was author Don Reardon on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. On this episode, our theme is Seriously? We are hearing stories of skepticism, opportunity, and getting blindsided.
We have one more story for you, but first, here's another song from local artist Anna Lynch.
This is a new one. Have a good night. Thank you so much for coming. This is not quite that happy, but okay. So if you want him, you can have him. And if you love him, I know you're blind. So if you see me in the corner crying, oh, go on and take him. No, I won't mind. Well, yes, I seen just what you see, and the one he wants ain't ever gonna be me. But that won't stop me from hanging on too long. So if you want him, consider me gone. So if you want him, you can have him. And if you love him, I know you're blind. So if you see me in the corner crying, oh, go on and take him. No, I won't mind. Oh, but keep in mind, while he's hanging the moon and such, for him, just one won't be enough. Oh, so if I lose him for some cold morning, no, I won't miss him. He ain't mine. So if you want him, you can have him. And if you love him, I know you're blind. So you won't see me in the corner crying. Oh, go on and take him. No, I won't mind. Oh, go on and take him. No, I won't mind. Thank you so much.
That was Anna Lynch, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Our last story comes from Anchorage resident Peter Van Tine. We're about to find out why nothing he owns is more than about 5 years old.
It was a December evening, 2009. Snowing, the reason we live in Alaska. Fantastic ski at Hillside. Snow in the trees, light breeze, 20 degrees. Great, 7:30 p.m., drive home, up the hill, pull in the car into the garage. Just wonderful night, casual evening with my family, as I'm wont to do on a weekday night, bed at 10. Warm and happy. 3 o'clock in the morning, muffled boom, then flap, flap, flap. My wife gets up and looks out the window next to her bed. She yells, "Flames!" I get up, I look out the window on the other side of the house, and all I can see in the front yard, which is snow-covered, a couple of feet of snow, it's bright orange and flickering. And I'm like, no kidding. We run out of the house. I first grab our 10-year-old daughter, 11-year-old daughter then, Liska, who was in the bedroom on that same floor. Grab her, run downstairs. Our 14-year-old daughter, Marielle, in the room above the garage where the explosion occurred, still asleep. 14-year-old girls can sleep through anything. I grab her by the lapel through the blanket, just grab the whole thing, and basically just throw her out the front door, which is just right next to the bedroom there. We're outside. We look at each other. We're like, we're all there. The dog at our heels, just sitting there right next to us. My wife and I look at each other. We're like, 911. I run back in the house. I go to the phone. Name, address. I got to get out. Click. Or fire, I probably said, too. That would have been relevant. I go back out. Liska, Marielle, dog. Where's Ilana? They're like, she went back inside. I'm like, what? Well, anyway, it was a four-letter word that I said. I go back in, and here's Ilana coming down from upstairs with two guinea pigs cradled in her arms. As we're going back out, I look at Marielle's room, which is right next to the front door, and from floor to ceiling, it is thick black smoke coming up out of that room, and the smoke alarm goes off at that moment. Outside, look around again. Are we all here? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's snowing. We're like, can't get past the driveway because the flames are 40 feet high. The side of that house on the south side is 40 feet high. The flames were taller than the side of the house that quick. Post hole through the front yard to the road. Walk to our neighbor friends, Karen and Steve's house. Knock on the door. Knock again. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. Pound on the door. They thankfully got up and let us in. And immediately, having been in that house so much and my kids since they were born, we were enveloped in warmth and spiritual warmth and physical warmth. It was wonderful. Put the kids on the couch, wrapped them up. My wife and I look at each other. We go, home office. We run our own business, our records, all of our computers. I'm like, I'm on it. I grab Steve's clothes, which ill-fitting as they were, and his boots, and I run back, dog at my heels. I go to the house, I'm going down the driveway, and kaboom, the second garage bay explodes out, a massive explosion. And I'm like, wow, I can't get past that. No way I can get past that. I'm thinking, okay, go around the north. So I run back out on the road, go to the other side of the house, and I start post-holing through the snow. It's all alders on that side of the house. I'm like, I can't get through this. And then I realized, you know, if I can get to the back of the house where the office is, it's locked. I'm not going to be able to get in unless I break a window. Maybe not a good idea when there's that much flame inside the house. Come back to the road. By that time, two police officers pull up. They get out of the car, and I'm standing at the top of the driveway with my dog next to me, looking at the house, and the flames are, I mean, spectacular explosions coming out of the garage still. And the two police officers stand next to me. My dog sees them, looks at me, gets up, walks around, walks between them, and sits down. I look at the police, they look at the house. Marshmallows? What are you going to do? What is it that caused this fire? Well, we had a, believe it or not, chain smoking fire investigator come in. He spent half of his life in smoky buildings and decided to spend the other half smoking, but a very, very skilled guy. And he walked me through the house and did his investigation, and he concluded that my car, which was a one-year-old Subaru, had somehow sprung a leak that night. It was soft roads. Remember, it was snowing. It was December night. So I didn't really understand how that could have happened. But anyway, I pulled in the garage at 8. The fuel leaked slowly over time. And over a period of 7 hours, the fumes had built up dense enough that when the pilot light flared up to heat up the furnace at 3 o'clock in the morning, it exploded. And that flapping sound was the sound of the garage door, which was just held on by a couple of wheels at the top, flapping against the side of the house. And it was that massive. Just a spectacular explosion on the one side. But what was that other explosion? Well, it was the other car in the garage, which had an absolutely full tank of gas, just a few minutes later, blowing up. So you think about that, and you know, you look at your situation. The fire department came up. They did a great job putting the fire out. They, you know, really to be lauded. We're above the water service, so they had to chain up and get up there. But the house was, what wasn't totally burned was so smoke damaged that you didn't want to touch it. But really, what does it matter? If you think about it, we weren't injured. Not a single molecule of smoke got into either of my kids' lungs, or the dog's for that matter, or my wife's, or mine. That's something to be grateful for. You know, my kids, were they mentally traumatized? They got a hell of a shopping spree with a big, I mean for months, a big fat insurance check. They're teenage girls, they went in shopping. It was okay. It still is to this day. But it does make you thoughtful. I think you can probably relate to that, right? You start thinking, well, really, boy, what is the meaning of all this? And to me, the question came to my mind, you know, what is it that makes a man happy? And I concluded, well, I don't know about other men, but for me, it's my wife, my two kids, my dog, and a pair of boxer shorts. And you know what? It was a good thing, because that night, that's all I had.
That was Peter Van Tine, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Thanks for tuning in. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. Our website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you, too, could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard, the storytellers for this show, and our musical guest, Anna Lynch. All of the proceeds from Arctic Entries shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about that is also on the Arctic Entries website. And a special thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Supersaturated Sugar Strings for our theme music, and to the Alaska Humanities Forum for their support. This year, we're working with the Humanities Forum to hear stories about Anchorage's 100-year history. To nominate a storyteller for this, please connect with us through our website. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSK Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come, and I love your lips, wanna give me some. Fuss and fight when things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what we will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiry. Darling, I don't need no more reassuring. Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who can ask for more? Of this year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love or just fall like the rain? We'll just have to see what we will be. We can swim on the same.